So there I was, minding my own business, just going along, when the vice abbess comes up to me and says, how would you like to give the Dharma talk on Sunday? And I said, on what? Oh, you can do it on anything you want. So I thought, silence. A whole hour of silence. That's what I will do, the great teaching. And then I thought, I don't think that's quite what she had in mind. So I did what I usually have to do in such situations, is to sort of sit with it and see what comes up as good to talk about. It's good to get into. And this is always a difficult time for me, because I have to wait until it comes to me. I can't go after it. It has to come to me. It doesn't mean I don't have responsibilities when it comes, but it has to come that way. And a few days ago, it did come, the topic, and I began to do a little bit of work on it. And the work that I did on it was to do no work on it, to leave it alone, let it sort of fester in the back of my mind. Anyway, what came through was to talk about something that had not to do with greed, hatred, and delusion. Because I have spoken about that so many times, as well as many monks, I thought, maybe there's something else that I could do. Maybe there's something else I could talk about. And something said, not necessarily, but that will give you a topic. And the topic was something called the mountains and rivers, the great earth with its mountains and rivers. And I thought, that? I'm to talk about that? What would I have to say? I mean, it says it at all. I mean, there's the great mountain, there's great earth with its mountains and rivers. But slowly, something has burbled up, and I will share that burbling with you. There are many ways in which the masters of our tradition, particularly the Chinese, because we have the whole range of stories about them, have, in a sense, talked about the same issue, but in a myriad different ways. And one that I like in particular, because it is one that is strange, and I have a penchant for the strange, and what it was is one about Yakusan Igen, or in Chinese, Yao Shan. Very great favorite of Dogen. Dogen loves to talk about Yao Shan. And it concerns just part of the story. He was in the meditation hall with his monks, and it was they ate there and they slept there and so forth. And one of his chaplains came up to him and said that there was a messenger outside, and he'd come from a very wealthy woman, and she was going to be making a very large donation to the temple. But she had something she wanted him to do, and that was she wanted to give this as the dana for the temple's doing a recitation of the whole of the Buddhist scriptures. Those of you who know this, these are books, well over 100 of them, all very big, very heavy, on very thin paper, with very tiny characters in Chinese. And there are millions and millions of things to read. And so he nodded and said he would do it. Whereupon he got up from the Dharma seat, which was his natural place to be sitting. He got up and he walked around, circumambulated, went around it three times. He bowed, went around it three times, bowed again, and sat down and said, I have recited all of the scriptures. Now, when you hear that, if you are slightly cynical or skeptical, you might say, you know, he's being cute. He's being funny. He's trying to get away with something, you know. A smart answer on the thing. Throw that at the lady and see what she does with her money with that one on the thing. Well, he was not being cute. He was not being funny. He was being deadly serious. But it's easy not to see why what he did was the recitation of the whole of all the scriptures in Buddhism. What does someone do? One looks at the Dharma, because it's the Dharma seat. And he occupies the Dharma seat and he speaks from it. And he goes around it three times. And each time he goes around, this is the whole of it, the completedness. It has no beginning, no end. It is a complete and perfect thing in and of itself. It is a circle. And that is the scriptures that he is going around. And the first he does it in honor of the Buddha, the second in the honor of the Dharma, and the third the honor of the Sangha. And he bows to the seat. He has not lost in any way the idea that in being in the Dharma seat, one is in control. He knows that it's the Dharma seat that needs to be bowed to, and not the Dharma seat bowing to him. This is the kind of thing that happens in the Dharma stories that we have of the Chan masters over and over again. And it's quite difficult for people because they will do or say things which seem very strange or seem very obvious, both of which are dangerous areas to go into because they can lead to a misunderstanding of what is being said and what is being talked about. There is the tendency with some to take everything that's said in the stories on a purely verbal, literal level, the most literal one that one can muster, and think that that is what they're talking about. Well, we have a story in which one of the masters referred to our ancestor Tozan, who was Soto. That's the To of Soto. His To comes from Tozan. And the person said, Tozan walked upon the waters. Oh, he's miraculous. You know, there's a story in the Bible of Jesus walking on the waters too, you know. He must have been quite an extraordinary monk to be able to do that and not sink. And indeed, I know from my own personal experience of having seen a newsreel once of someone in India who claimed that he could walk upon the waters and invited everybody to come and see him do it. And that included people who were newsreel photographers. So it was all put right on of his walking on the waters. And he goes on and he walks right out and sinks down to the bottom. You know, oops. So obviously he was thinking of something else. So what is this thing that Tozan did? He didn't say, Tozan walked upon the waters and he sank down to his knees. He doesn't say that. He says he walked upon the waters. What is he talking about? What is being said here? Oh, the answer is, oh, of course, it's not literal. It's deep. It's deeper than deep. It's tremendously deep. You see, it isn't Tozan himself who walked upon the waters. Tozan means the Mount Tol, which of course is where his name comes from, but that was where his monastery was. It's the mountain itself that walks upon the waters. And one says, oh, is it? Really? How interesting. But what does that mean? Well, it's something so deep, so profound, you couldn't possibly get it without many, many decades of training and work and spiritual studying. And maybe you might get a glimpse, just a snitch of a glimpse of what it means to say the mountain walks upon the water. And you might say he's making this up just to be funny and dramatic. But I actually heard something almost exactly that of someone claiming that. Of walking on the waters and understanding it in that way, in all seriousness. And I thought, well, you know, there are people, and then there are people. But what does it mean? Well, it has to do with mountains and rivers. The great earth with its mountains and rivers. What is this about? This is a phrase that comes up in Dogen over and over and over again, and it can be taken back to various masters, and they themselves have repeated this phrase of the great earth with its mountains and rivers. And keep in mind, mountains here walk upon the water. This is the walking upon the water. And Dogen seems to support this. He seems to be saying, yes, of course he did. Of course Tozan walked upon the waters. But you have to know what mountains are. You have to know what waters are. You have to know what the great earth is. And we can understand some of it. We can penetrate some of it fairly easily in explaining what we call the Zen code, the way what these terms mean. But there's a difficulty that still will arise for us, because there's a tendency for us to try to understand what any of these things are, even if we're serious about looking for the spiritual meaning, of looking at them and trying to understand them within the context of our own culture. And the problem is, these come out of Chinese culture, and they have a meaning in Chinese culture that is not exactly the same, and you have no way of knowing this by reading it, because you have the problem that the translators lament. How am I going to put this verbal text into verbal English and at the same time convey with that all the associations that are attached to it in Chinese culture, which do not exist in Western culture? And that's what's known as the translator's lament. And you hear his moans and groans as you read the translations. That's what makes translations hard to read. There's loud, all this loud moaning that's going on. Anyway, it is a phrase that needs looking at more carefully. The great earth is on one level, on the common level, it is the planet Earth. Because there is something else that is involved with the planet Earth. And we are apt to miss it. I had a conversation with Reverend Berthold the other day. We got on to talking about something, and I put something to him, which I had not really had thought about, but then I thought, pardon the repetition, but I thought it might be useful to consider, because it may help you to understand what the great earth is. I have a room, a private room. As a senior, I have a private room in the Abbey. It happens to be physically the largest room in the Abbey, probably, for monks to live in. Now, the reason I have that is because of what I have. And that is, I have my altar with its various things. In fact, I have a couple of altars around the room. And it has all the objects there that are there. And when you see it, if you were to come in the door, you would see it immediately, because it's right straight in front of you. And that's a very important thing, because that's the focus, the altar. All that's in the room comes from that altar, in effect, comes out of that. As you go along, you see on your left and right bookshelves. One goes up to the ceiling, and loaded with books, loaded with things. The books even have books, in effect. You know, you put all the books like this, and then you put a couple like this to fill in the space, so they won't get lonely. And then you come in, and on your left, there is my bedroom, which means my bed and my nightlight. And there are some sliding panels, and inside of those are my wardrobe and my kitchen and my pantry, because I have diabetic problems with my eating, and I have to have certain kinds of food up in my room. So you have a range of things that are all piled in there. And then as you go along, the next thing you come to is my office, which is my desk, which has innumerable papers piled upon it. And then you go along a little farther and you come to my computer room, which has my Duke computers, which I use for doing translation work. Then on the other side of that, is my craft area for my doing my embroidery work and other forms of craft. And then there is, in the middle, there is a, and then there is, in the middle, there is a place for people to come as guests, a kind of sitting room that I have. Now, this is almost an impossible task, but it is not totally impossible. If I were to ask someone to list, make a list of everything that is in that room, because this is, you know, Zen sparseness carried to a degree, unimaginable degree of Zen sparseness. Make a list of every single thing. Now, the chances are, they might miss, you know, this or that or the other, but the chances are it could be done. It's theoretically possible to do this and make a list of everything. And the probability is very, very high that there'll be one thing they will not list. And that is the space. They will forget to list the space because the space is in the room. And everything that's in that room is in the space, and the space itself is in the space as well. And there's more space in the room than there are, quote, things in the space. It's a different way of looking. It's forgetting, as we are apt to, that there is space. And there are people who translate that as the void. I don't think anybody would come up with the word void to describe what's in my room. It's not void. But it is, as Reverend Matthew called, the fullest emptiness that you can imagine on one level. It is that. And that is why it is permitted for me to have all of that, because I know that it is all in the realm of emptiness. Is nothing there is permanent, nothing there that will last. All will come, reside for a while, and move on. Now, much of it may not, unless I get moved out of the room, if I'm there when I die, and it's as good a place to die as any, is in my room, then the things in my room will be dispersed and they will go their way. And that's fine too. And there are monks who have come, who have gotten interested in something, and I look at it and I say, well, I used to do that, but I really don't do that anymore. Here, I'll give you the books, I'll give you the materials, I'll give you this, I'll give you that. And it's gone. It goes. So there's nothing there that's permanent, there's nothing that's, quote, mine. It's just what's there, and it's in space. It is in the emptiness. But remember, it's not something to be overlooked. Now, when we speak of the great earth, that includes not only the physical planet earth. It is the whole. It is the all. And in some of the scriptures, that great earth is talked about by the term the 10 quarters of the universe. It'll say all 10 quarters of the universe, or something of this sort, will be talked about. Now, the 10 quarters is very simple. We can understand 10 quarters. That's the 9 divisions of the universe, or 8, 9, 10. And you have north, south, east, west, northwest, southwest, northeast, southeast, above and below. And there you've got 10. It includes them all, everything. Everything's included in the 10 quarters. And this is very Chinese and is very non-Western. There are 10. This is not insignificant. The word for complete, for all, in Japanese, is jubun, the 10 parts. Or as we would say, 100%. That's their equivalent of 100%. So 100% of whatever is, the great earth, the space, it's everything. It's the whole. We could say, well, it's the whole of the universe, but it's the whole of the universe among all the other wholes of the universe that exist wholly. until the mind boggles by trying to put universes within universes and see them. If you want your mind boggled, read chapter 2 in the Avatamsaka scripture, and you will know immediately how to get your mind boggled by numbers. You know, you keep feeling, if I stop reading this, I'll never find my way back to where I was. But it gives you a feeling of what it's like to come into a room, look at what's there, and then turn a little, and look at what's there, and turn a little, and look at what's there. And that's what that chapter does. And it's a mind boggle. And it's intended to boggle the mind. That's its purpose, its function, to get one out of conventional ways of thinking, conventional attitudes of mind that we inherit from our culture without ever questioning, and think this is what reality is, this is what the universe is, this is what the world is, when we have already denied this space as being part of the world. There's the earth, yes, and there's the great earth, and the great earth is the earth and everything. And the earth, like ourselves, is not something that is objective, nor is it subjective. It's not something that is out there and we're here, or something inside us and as we sit here. And yet we tend to think in those terms of inside and outside. We can find ways of saying, well, this all this stuff you see is outside of you, all this stuff you've got in your room, it's all outside. And the answer is no. It's all inside me. I carry it with me. I know where the things are. Most of the time, there are occasions when some of the books at night seem to have walked away to some other place, but maybe they won't talk with the other book. Something, but they have moved off, and I have trouble capturing them, bringing them back. But those who have pets know that this too is a similar activity. So it's great earth is more than just being the earth. And we ourselves are the same. We are the great earth. And we must not deny the space in which we live. Because if there were not space, where would we be? Where could we be? There's no place we could be. There wouldn't be space for being there. Now, the great earth has mountains and rivers. Everybody knows that. And everybody knows what that means. Doesn't everybody know what that means? I look and see some faces there that are not quite sure that they know what it means. Although I suspect some might say, well, I used to know until you opened your mouth. Well, I'm going to open my mouth a bit more on that. This, and get into mountains and rivers. Mountains, it's one of the easy things. We can speak about metaphors. And that makes it sort of safe. This is a metaphor for something. And as it used to be said around here, fortunately, I haven't heard people saying it for a long time, Reverend Master made the remark that metaphors have multiple meanings. And she is correct in what she said. And if you understand what she said in a certain way, you are incorrect in understanding. Metaphors have multiple meanings, and when they are put into a context, they lose that multiplicity most of the time. There are very few cases where you will find that. Now, we can see this very simply in English with the word beam. If you think of the word beam, something may come to mind. And it may be a beam of light. But it could just as well be a beam in the ceiling. Or the beam on someone's face. They're all beams. Well, what is the beam? Here, you know, we've got a text here, you know, and it says beam. What is that? What are they talking about? Well, usually something is going to be said that's going to give it away. That it was the beam of the headlights. Or the beam in the ceiling. Or the beam on somebody's face. There'll be something to wipe out the ambiguity. And the strange thing with us is we don't have any problem with that. When we hear the word beam, even though if we hear it in isolation, we might intellectually think up these three different meanings, but nevertheless, when we're having a conversation and somebody says, look out, the beam is about to fall on you, you're not looking for a flashlight. You immediately know what to do, you know, how to solve the ambiguity. Now, but we have our ambiguities. The Chinese have theirs. And mountain is one of them. There are things that are called mountains. These are geological structures. We can perceive them. We can interpret our perceptions and be fairly comfortable knowing that across the street from us is Mount Shasta, and it is a mountain. You know, no problem. That's on the literal most level. If you try to fit that literal most level into something that is a metaphor or is being used in that way, then you may begin to get into an uneasy area with your mind. It's to say, like, the mountain is walking on the road. Well, you know, Mount Shasta's going to walk down whatever the river is around here. Is that what's going to happen? And the answer is, well, not if you understand it as a geological structure. Don't worry, unless the mountain blows. If the mountain blows, all bets are off. Yes, it may flow down the river. There's also the meaning of mountain, which means a monastery. And this is quite often, you run this again in texts. If you read Dogen, because I do the Dogen stuff, so I'm into Dogen more. But in Dogen, you run into this about mountains as places where there are monasteries. So he left home and went up the mountain. Well, he may have gone physically up the mountain, but mainly what he's doing is going to a monastery. It's another meaning of mountain. Now, one can say, well, what about temples that don't have mountains? Do they go up? How do they do that? Now, that's like, some people have a mind that sort of works that way and needs to get that one straightened out. So just in case, there are places in China where the land is very flat. So, you know, they can't point to an anthill and say, see, there's the mountain. But they will do something similar to that of making something be the mountain so that the monastery can be on a mountain. All monasteries are on mountains, even when there aren't mountains for them to be on. That's a nice Buddhist way of thinking about things. It sort of covers everything in sort of a blur. Now, there's something else that is a mountain. And that is the abbot of the temple, the founder of it, may very well take on the name, or after his death, be given the name of the mountain as his name. So you have Tozan, which literally means Mount Tall. So you have a mountain there, and the monk is the mountain. There's a story, again, about Yakusan, in which he had a young... This is one of these things you have to sort of pull out the information that's very... it's just enough to get the sense of it, and you have to fill it in. But basically what it was, there was a young monk who had come to his monastery. And it's apparent from the conditions in the story that he was very, very new. Very, very new to being in there. And he'd been probably given just the essential aspect of training in a monastery, which was to sit there. Go sit. You know, it's just about what you got when those people of you who came here for the retreat, you may have gotten just, you know, a bit more than that, but teaching you how to do meditation. So you go and do meditation. Well, this young monk went in and was doing the meditation, but evidently it didn't sink in. And he began to do something. And only if you are into being a monk in Soto tradition do you see why this is odd. He must have been looking around. Because after the meditation was over, he went to Yako-san and said, during the meditation, while you were sitting there, you looked as still as a mountain. What were you thinking about? And Yaku-san's answer to that, in effect, was that he was not thinking about anything in particular. And it's because Yaku-san had picked up that what this monk was really asking is, gee, I want to sit like that. I want to be as still as that. So if I know what he was thinking, I can think that, and then I will know how to be as still as a mountain. And that's not what the practice is. I apologize for the noises coming through your ear. So, a mountain can also be someone who is sitting doing meditation. And you will run into phrases in translation to talk about sitting in the midst of the mountains. They are sitting in a zendo. They're sitting in a meditation hall. Surrounded by mountains, monks who are sitting as still as a mountain. And that's a common metaphor. And you have to tell from the context which of these things is the mountain that is being talked about. And this isn't all. There's still another. And that is in one of our scriptures that we recite, and you all heard it. And it talks about obstructing mountains and great rivers. Oh, now I understand. They're all obstructionists. All the monks are obstructionists. And the greatest one is the abbot. He's the big obstruction. And some of you laugh. But that's all tied into the idea of mountains. Those are multiple meanings of mountain as a metaphor. But each of them is distinct in its meaning. The answer then is, can it mean two of those? Is it possible that it could have two meanings? There are some things in Buddhism, in the translation stuff, that do have two meanings. And you run into this particularly with the dialogues between an inexperienced monk and the master. And the inexperienced monk will ask something, or the master will say something, and the inexperienced monk will take it on the most literal level, when the master means it on something far, far from literal. It was a custom in Chinese monasteries, and it may also have been in others as well, but I know about it via Dogen, about the Chinese ways of doing it. It was a custom that when a new person came to the monastery to be a monk, or was already, for some reason, a monk, they would have what is called the personal interview. And it was usually conducted by the abbot or by one of the senior monks. And basically, what certain of these monks would do would be to test. They would try to test what's going on with this person. Where are they in terms of the spiritual practice? Do they have any clue of what they're getting into? Or are they just people who are coming here because they have rice and they're hungry? And maybe they can come. And you don't have to do any work, all you do is sit and meditate. And, hey, that's not so bad. It's better than starving to death under a bridge somewhere. And go, but isn't that? Or it may be somebody just, they've heard about it, thought they'd give it a try, or whatever. Well, there was one monk who would ask a certain question. And his question was to ask the people that came to him, he'd say, what is your shin? And shin, in conventional Chinese, means, what is your family name? And it was quite common for this new person to say, oh, my family name is Lee. Because you didn't give your personal name. You gave your family name. That was the main thing. What was your family name? My family name was Zhang. And so forth. Oh, that's nice. And then he'd have his assistant take the person off and put them in the back row with all the novices. You know, put them way in the back. And let them stew for a while and see if anything comes up. But right now, that's about as much as they can handle. But there was one day, one of them came and was asked, what is your Xin? Well, Xin has another meaning. It has exactly the same pronunciation, but it has another meaning. It's written with a similar but different character in Chinese. And it means, what is your true nature? And that's the question that this newly approached monk answered and spoke in terms of true nature, Buddha nature. And the abbot thought, aha, I've got a live one here. So he called an assistant and said, have him go over and sit over on that side, right there, up in the front part. So he was put in with he was in with the novices, but right in the very front, where he could hear everything the master had to say. Because what would happen in Dharma talks quite often was, while the master had come in to give the Dharma talk, presumably everybody was sitting there ready to hear. Well, all the seniors were there, and all of them were ready to hear. And then there were the novices who were coming in and talking and chattering and whispering and spreading their mats and sitting down and making and fluffing their clothes and doing this and doing that. And they missed the first half of the talk. He didn't want this person to miss anything. So he put him in a place. And then if some of the others, if they come along, burbling along, you know, we'll see. But this was one that was a live one. And this happens in other places too. Other stories. And you have this sense of what a mountain is and how one uses language to find out who is and who is not a mountain. A mountain among mountains. And in the area of mountains, you still have the question of obstructing mountains and great rivers. What is an obstructing mountain? Well, that's very simple. An obstructing mountain is something that gets in our way when we know perfectly well how to go ahead with our training and we know it's not that way and the mountain's in our way. That's an obstruction. Now, that means I've either got to go over it, which is dangerous, or go around it, which is tedious. And who knows what I'm going to meet if I go around it. But this mountain here is really very, very much in my way. And, of course, all of you who have done training will be able to recognize that meaning of something being an obstruction, something getting in my way. And it's always getting in my way. My way is the way. I know which way to go, and the mountain's in my way. The mountain is not in one's way. It's preventing us from going a way in which we're determined to go, and this straightens us out by making us go round or over. But not necessarily what we think is the straight way to enlightenment. We want the road to be easy. We want the road to be straight. We don't want to waste time going this way and that. Well, the Christians have a saying, God writes with a crooked line. This is the, okay, that's the way you go. You go along. And what becomes ultimately happens is you, one day you wake up to the fact that the obstructing mountain was there to help, not to hinder, to get you out of your head and not hammer it closed. So we got mountains going. I come to rivers. Rivers. Well, we know one thing about rivers, if we know nothing else. They're not mountains. And oh, are we wrong? That's why a mountain can walk upon the water. What the water is, which is the character, actually it's the character, what this is, it combines with the word with for mountain. And you have Shanshui. And this is the word that in painting is called a landscape. It's the whole of everything we see and know and experience and think of as not being in space when it is in space. And we see all the phenomena that go on in the sky about us as well, that are all part of the landscape. Nothing is left out of the landscape. And when you see Chinese paintings and Japanese paintings, particularly those under Buddhist influence, you see, you become terribly aware of space. Because it is the space playing with that which is non-space, and the non-space playing with that which is space. In the West, what do we do with paintings? We tend to take the canvas and fill it all up with things, stuff. You know, trees and mountains and things, but everything is filled in. Everything is accounted for. And that's what we call a landscape. But in Chinese, the landscape is open. You get a bit of rock here, and a cliff there, and some pine trees over there, and some people, and some houses, and a boat, and so forth. But they're there, and there, and there, and there. Just scattered. But they're all part of the landscape. They're not separate from it. And there is no I that is separate from it. So when you look at it, you're going into this world of landscape. And you become part of it. Even though you are not, quote, in the painting, it isn't a painting of you, but you are, in a sense, looking into a universe, the whole universe, and all that it contains. And there are things we see, and there are things we don't see. And as you look, you'll find that there are things that are there, that you only know are there because you tripped over them. But they're there. And seeing them there. And being willing to live in the universe, not as something as a separate entity, but as an integral part of the whole of the universe. And it's not a part separate from. It's a part with. And this is what we are. This is our life. We are part of the whole universe. We're in it. We're not separate from it. And yet the tendency is for us, because of our culture, to ignore space because it isn't physically, tangibly there. Have you ever seen two birds fighting in the sky, fighting over a piece of sky? You're in my piece of sky. Go away, go away. But it's not. They're not, if, you know. There's no need to fight. There's enough sky for everybody. And that, of course, is the word for emptiness in Chinese. It's the word for sky. That which is unbounded, unlimited. And in Buddhism, we call that the eternal. But when we do that, we shift. And the shift is to take it from conventional thinking into what one of the monks used the term, I'm not sure I like it, but he called the transcendent meaning. A meaning that has meaning in terms of the eternal, rather than just simply a something that you can explain intellectually. It takes you into something deeper and greater, and you need a vocabulary for that, that will point people to it. It's what, you know, the famous thing about the finger pointing to the moon. Don't take the finger for the moon. Don't get also involved with the moon. Look where the finger is pointing. And don't go arguing over words. Somebody's trying to point something. Point away. Point what's there. And this is what's happening here with water. What is the water? What was the mountain that could walk on water? And the answer is the water is the water that you write with a capital W. We call it, the water of the Spirit. That which flows through us. When you learn to meditate, one of the things you're taught to do, you may not understand it, but as you do the training, if you don't understand it at first, chances are in time you will. And that is what we call circulating the breath. It's the same thing. It's bringing it up the back and over and down. And it's like water coming up and going, flowing down, going up and flowing down. It's the water of the Spirit. And that's the water that the mountain walks upon. And that is the mountain, that's the water that the Reverend Tozan walked upon. There is no difference between mountain and water. One may look as still as a mountain, but even though one is sitting there as still as a mountain, one is not dead. One is not blissed out. That's not the goal. Oh, I want to do meditation. I can be away from this awful world and everything. I can just sit there and just inhale things, sweet smelling things. And it isn't that way. It isn't that way. That's not the way to go. That's the way of light and love. And it always denies what's there. Because in reality, there are the stones and the pebbles we trip over. And we stub our toes against. And we cannot, quote, get rid of all of that by just sitting in meditation and thinking, if I sit here long enough, all troubles will dissolve. No, because you're going to get something awful happen to your knees or your back or to some other part of you. Something's going to happen to you. Just sit long enough and that will happen. So it's a matter of things going on at all times. To watch the flow of thoughts as they arise, persist for a while, and dissolve. The feelings that come up and do this. Seeing those, experiencing those, and keeping still within them, to sit as still as a mountain within the ever-changing quality, the ever-flowing part of our mind. We are the mountains. We are the river. We are the great earth. And none of us is excluded. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.